On this edition for Sunday, May 24th, a cautious reopening for Memorial Day weekend. A little-known alternative to layoffs that may be catching on.
We don't get it!
Shut it down!
And climate activists pivot online to include COVID-19 concerns. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. This Memorial Day weekend, flags across the country are flying at half staff through dusk tonight to honor those who've lost their lives to the coronavirus. Tomorrow, when the nation honors those who lost their lives in military service, flags will again be lowered. The global pandemic continues to take lives, even as governments begin to allow larger gatherings and reopenings, with the hope that people will still keep their distance and keep the virus from reemerging. Let's get started with today's top stories.
It feels great to have guests on the park again. To actually enter the park, you need to reserve a spot online.
Americans are on the move this holiday weekend, going to visit newly opened amusement parks and restaurants. Although the virus spread slowed in most areas, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported more than 24,000 new cases yesterday. On some newly opened beaches this weekend, there were scenes of crowds that raised concerns about the virus resurging as reopenings increase. The White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx urged people to wear face coverings outdoors this holiday weekend if they can't stay 6 feet apart.
I think it's our job as public health officials every day to be informing the public that what puts them at risk. And we've made it clear that there's asymptomatic spread. And that means that people are spreading the virus unknowingly. And this is unusual in the case of respiratory diseases in many cases. So you don't know who's infected. And so we really want to be clear all the time that social distancing is absolutely critical. And if you can't social distance and you're outside, you must wear a mask.
The Trump administration announced today that it is banning travel from Brazil. The ban does not apply to citizens or legal residents of the United States. The decision comes as Brazil now has more confirmed coronavirus cases than any country in the world besides the United States. Brazil's health ministry said there are now more than 347,000 cases of coronavirus, surpassing Russia as the number two hotspot globally. Despite regional lockdowns, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro showed up to a rally supporting him in Brasilia today. Bolsonaro has come under criticism for his handling of the pandemic and for alleged interference in a corruption probe into his family. Yesterday, Brazilian officials announced that there were 965 coronavirus-related deaths in the previous 24 hours. Thousands of demonstrators returned to the streets of Hong Kong today to march against mainland China's new national security legislation. Police fired tear gas at the protesters who say that Beijing's proposal to ban subversive activity and foreign interference threatens Hong Kong's autonomy. The law would bypass Hong Kong's legislature and could allow security agencies from mainland China to set up offices in the city. The new security legislation is expected to be approved by China's parliament later this week. The long-awaited corruption trial for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu began in Jerusalem today. After arriving at the courthouse, Netanyahu accused police and prosecutors of trying to depose him and claimed he is the victim of a conspiracy. The Prime Minister is charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes, accusations he denies. Netanyahu is the first sitting Prime Minister in Israel's history to stand trial, and legal analysts say the case could last for years. The government of Afghanistan and the Taliban announced a 3-day ceasefire for the Eid al-Fitr holiday. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said all security forces would observe the halt in fighting, which begins today. In a goodwill gesture, Ghani also started a process to release up to 2,000 Taliban prisoners Hundreds of Afghans gathered today to attend Eid prayers, which were held outside to help prevent the spread of coronavirus. The holiday marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. You can find all of our coverage of the global outbreak and the latest national and international news at pbs.org/newshour. There's been a lot of discussion about contact tracing to help curtail the spread of the coronavirus outbreak. But in this era of advanced technology with global tracking and digital locators, the process for tracking the virus may require old-school techniques. ProPublica's Caroline Chen took a deep dive into contact tracing and joined me recently to discuss what may be coming. Caroline, let's talk about contact tracing. This is not that new an idea, but it's very different in how much we need it today.
Yeah, absolutely. We have been actually using contact tracing for decades and decades for many different types of diseases, including STDs like HIV and syphilis, and for diseases like tuberculosis. But the big challenge right now is just how big the coronavirus outbreak is. So what the U.S. needs right now is massive numbers of people to do contact tracing.
And is this a job where they're going to have to go door to door because people are concerned that, hey, I don't want to actually be a contact tracer if I'm going to have to go meet people who are sick?
No. So this can all be done over the phone. And in fact, these can be remote jobs. So a lot of the states that are hiring people right now, this is a job that you can do from home.
That's great. Now, what does a contact tracer do over the phone?
So public health departments will get information from labs on positive patients. And so they'll get the information, say, you know, that Bob has gotten a positive test. So they'll call Bob, you know, hi, they'll check up on how Bob's doing and what his symptoms are. And then they'll also ask, hey, you know, can you review with you who you've been in touch with? And the CDC guidance right now is 2 days before you started to get symptoms, because that's the period in which you were probably most infected. And the definition of a contact, according to the CDC right now, is someone who you were within 6 feet of for more than 15 minutes. And then they'll ask, you know, do you remember people's phone numbers? You know, this is why they're called disease detectives as well. That's another word for contact tracers. You really have to do some sleuthing here. And they'll get that information and then start contacting these people who were close contacts with Bob. Now, they don't ever actually give Bob's name, though. So there is this level of anonymity where they'll call, then say, Jane and say, hey, Jane, we have information that you were within close contact of someone who tested positive for the coronavirus, and ask Jane to then be in quarantine for 14 days.
So give me an example of the scale of contact tracers that we would need to pull this off, considering that our data shows that there are still new infections, officially recognized and diagnosed ones, that are happening every day.
One statistic that's really stuck in my mind is that the city of Wuhan, China, has about 11 million residents. And at the peak of their infection, at one point they had 9,000 contact tracers. And that's a ratio of 81 contact tracers per 100,000 residents. Right now, in the U.S., so if you take, I think the highest that I've heard is California says that they would hire up to 20,000 contact tracers. So that'd be in the range of about 50 contact tracers per 100,000 residents. So still not up to Wuhan levels. So basically, I think the takeaway is we need a lot more.
What do I need if I want to be a contact tracer, considering there are a lot of people that are unemployed right now, that might be looking for a work that they can do from home? This sounds pretty good. What kind of qualifications do I have to have?
A lot of people have compared it to, you know, like census taking type of jobs. It's sort of a similar level of education. And I've looked, you know, state by state, different states have different requirements. So I would say you really probably want to go look at your specific state's requirements. But I think the hardest part of this job is not just data collection, but really empathy and getting trust from the person on the phone, because you're calling someone and oftentimes you're giving them really bad news. You're telling them either you're infected or you've been in close contact with someone who's been infected, and it's a real shock. And the thing that states really need to think about is you're not there to like just like extract information from someone, but you're there to then equip and enable someone to be able to comply with what they then need to do, which is stay at home for a relatively long period of time. So you need to have social services engaged. You need to have this person trust you and understand why it's so important to break the chains of transmission. And so really, people need to be trained in communication, do that job well alongside being able to gather good information.
Caroline Chan at ProPublica, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The coronavirus pandemic has put every country to the test. Whether measuring infection rates, mortality, or unemployment, the results vary dramatically. Here in the U.S., the government is weighing whether or not to provide another stimulus package, as more than 38 million people have filed for unemployment since mid-March. In Germany, the number of people out of work during stay-at-home orders surged, but a state-funded short-term program there helped many avoid layoffs. It's a work-sharing agreement that some here in the U.S. are hoping may catch on. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has more.
With the passage of the landmark CARES Act in March, the headline was, financial relief was on its way for millions of Americans. As companies slashed jobs, the nearly $2 trillion relief bill meant that on top of a one-time stimulus check, an additional $600 a week in federal unemployment insurance would be made available for those suddenly out of work. But buried deep in the document was something else, additional support for little-known state programs that can help businesses avoid having to lay people off in the first place.
I learned about WorkShare because I actually started reporting a story about the unemployment system in my capacity as a journalist at the LA Times. Right at the same time I was working on that, our management came to us and said that they wanted $2 million in cuts from our newsroom.
Matt Pierce is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and an elected guild member of the newspaper's union.
You know, there are other programs out there like PPP that small businesses have applied for to keep workers on their payroll and sometimes keep them working. We were too big to be eligible for that. We also didn't have access to the Treasury program for mid-sized business loans. So we reached for the next closest tool, which was the work sharing program.
California is one of 25 states, along with the District of Columbia, that have what is known as a work share or short-term compensation program. Such programs allow companies to avoid layoffs in exchange for a reduction in employee hours. A percentage of the employees' lost wages are offset with unemployment insurance, which comes out of state funds. But under the CARES Act, those payouts are being reimbursed by the federal government.
We had trouble actually finding other employers who had experience with this program. I mean, this was the craziest thing when I was making phone calls, even among labor people in California. They didn't have much experience with it.
But Pierce and the Guild did figure it out and convinced management to agree to a 12-week work share program. Cutting hours for everyone by 20%, the agreement saved 84 jobs.
That's really the attractive thing about this program. You don't have to lay people off just to save the business. Everyone can take a collective hit, protect some people so that they don't get thrown out into the unemployment line. It really seems like a win-win for all of us.
It is a program that I think in many respects is ideally suited for this recession.
Susan Hausman is the Vice President and Director of Research with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. The Michigan organization was founded 75 years ago to study policy-related issues of employment and unemployment.
The causes of this recession were not economic in nature. It was a health pandemic, and what ideally we'd like to do is to hold things in place as we get better control of the virus, ramp up as quickly as possible. There's not fundamental restructuring that needs to be done in the economy.
Much of the immediate job losses were in the service sector of our economy. Is it possible to have a work share program for someone that works at a restaurant, for the bartender, for someone that works in retail?
In principle, absolutely.
But again, that is if it's available in your state and employers know about it. In 2017, Hausman was a co-author of a study that looked at how to expand workshare programs already in existence in Iowa and Oregon.
And the baseline in Iowa for employers knowing about this program, bear in mind this has been running for years in Iowa, was 10%. and in Oregon, it was about 25%.
25% of employers knew about this in Oregon, and only 10% knew about it in Iowa?
Correct. Many employers don't know about it. And if you think about it, it was just within the last several years that nine of these states, including mine, Michigan, introduced this program, and we were in an expansion. So I would imagine that very few employers, when this hit, and it hit quickly, this recession, knew about it.
There are those who argue the lack of work share is not just about policy, but something much more complicated. And this can be seen nowhere more than in the difference in unemployment between the United States and Germany. At the end of April, the German unemployment rate was 5.8%. Meanwhile, in the U.S., it was 14.7%.
Well, what's the difference? And of course, culture's the difference.
Thomas Kohler is a labor scholar and professor of law and philosophy at Boston College.
So what has made the difference? Their so-called Kurzarbeit or short work system. What Kurzarbeit does is give an incentive to employers and employees to continue to work or continue to train. And the government will subsidize that. The idea being this is a lot cheaper than having a large body of unemployed people who end up, if they're out of the labor market too long, they have difficulty getting back into it.
According to the German IFO Institute for Economic Research, half of all German firms, covering as many as 10 million German workers, are currently utilizing Kurzarbeit.
To do something as structurally comprehensive as Germans have done would require a lot of change in our attitudes. You can never look at a model and buy it and take it home. It won't work that way. You need a certain culture to do it. But there's a lot we could learn from it.
Do you anticipate employment policy will change in the U.S. in response to this crisis?
I think at some point it absolutely has to. We have too many people who have literally no protections at all. It's clear to me that we need a new way to think about work and how we order it.
I can see from firsthand experience now, you know, not as a journalist, but as someone, you know, representing my coworkers, why it's so difficult to promote these programs in the U.S. They're just, it's easier to lay people off. There's not a culture of spreading around the pain to protect people in these times of temporary economic crunches. So we're thankful that this is here. We're just going to try to survive this round of the fight and then get on to the next battle, which could be 12 weeks from now, 6 months from now, a year from now.
The CARES Act funds programs through the end of 2020. The current LA Times deal lasts until the end of July. While Pierce is unclear what happens after, his phone has been ringing, the calls coming from other newsrooms across the country looking for advice.
Christopher Booker has more on work sharing at our Instagram account. While the environmental effects of COVID-19 are still being studied, research shows that there is a disproportionate impact on marginalized communities and people of color. Now, activists behind the in-person climate protests that were gaining momentum in the last few years are pivoting to keep the public's focus on both crises. They're finding online ways to organize and continue their advocacy. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano reports.
Last year, high school youth and New York-based indigenous climate activist Xie Bastida led hundreds of students in mass strikes as part of Fridays for Future, a walkout climate protest started by teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg.
When you disrupt the system, that is when people pay attention to you. So for the first global climate strike on March 15th, I organized my school to strike and I got 600 kids to walk out. And on the streets is where I met my fellow organizers from around New York City. And ever since we got together, started organizing, and got 300,000 people to strike on September 20th.
The youth protest movement brought more than 10 million to the streets in September. Bastida and climate activists around the world were gearing up to do more in-person actions for the 50th anniversary of Earth Day at the end of April. But then the coronavirus pandemic began and stay-at-home orders were issued.
It like really disrupted kind of like our upward trend of having impact in different places, but it united us in a different way because climate activism is about community. So we shifted all of our organizing that was going to happen on the streets to online activism.
The focus on online environmental activism has only grown. For Earth Day on April 22nd, climate justice organizations like 350.org helped organize a 72-hour live stream event, which had over 4.8 million views from around the world.
how do you advocate, lobby, and create critical moments of pressure when you can't get into someone's face?
Tamara Tolles O'Loughlin is the North America Director for 350.org. The group created online toolkits for different ways of organizing around the climate, such as virtual banner projects, online training, and outreach tutorials.
How do you get people who aren't in the same place to connect about big ideas and create space for conversations? Some of that's just plain old education about what the facts are, resources and toolkits, templates for how to communicate with your representative. So figuring out what it is people need where they are is just an extension of what we have been doing as an international global organization that's been working on climate for over a decade.
On May 14th, the organization gathered more than 600 people for an online discussion that included the relationship between climate change and COVID-19. Other groups are also finding new ways of taking direct social action.
We have pivoted to organizing in a way that is totally consistent with keeping those distancing requirements in place.
Kaya Chatterjee is the executive director of the U.S. Climate Action Network, a coalition of hundreds of organizations active on climate change.
We just launched something called Arm in Arm, where any three people, anywhere they are in the country, can take leadership and start doing what we are calling disruptive humanitarianism. Whether that means, you know, planting orchards in the way of pipelines or closing off streets so kids can go outside for the first time in a month, you don't actually need to gather a lot of people to disrupt systems.
The network also started an online campaign called the People's Bailout. It urges citizens to call their elected representatives to demand they address the social inequities of climate change, which activists say now risk being intensified by the federal government's response to COVID-19.
If you look at who has been most badly affected by COVID-19, it is Indigenous, Black, Latinx communities, the very same communities hit worst by the climate crisis. Even geographically, the overlap, if you look at, you know, Louisiana, you know, parts of New York, Detroit, these are places that have been really badly hit by environmental injustices and climate injustices.
Youth climate activist Shie Bastida says if nothing else, the COVID-19 pandemic has made the threat of climate change to marginal communities clear.
I was born and raised in Mexico. And when I was 13 years old, my town flooded heavily. And not only that, but the waste that we had from a lot of the neighboring factories spilled over on the streets. So it was pollution and the effects of the climate crisis combined into something that completely made my town unstable economically. So ever since, that was like my wake-up call.
What COVID has done is rip the Band-Aid off and let people know that if you don't have access and you don't have resources, then you don't have a response to a crisis that will only continue to be compounded as climate makes pandemics more likely. So for example, in this moment, we were planning before now to focus on flood and fire season for people that are stable around what they could do in COVID. They will be forced to consider whether they can continue to shelter in place in places where there are floods, where there are fires, where it's just too hot or electricity may go out because of brownouts.
A new study this week by a group of international scientists found that global carbon dioxide emissions dropped by 17% in April during the coronavirus lockdown. Yet Bastida says it shouldn't take a health crisis to heal the planet.
Because it is actually harming a lot of communities. And the coronavirus pandemic is only stopping mass production of things. And we can achieve low carbon emissions by switching to renewable energy. We have to keep fighting for climate justice.
This coming week, two American astronauts will blast off on a mission to the International Space Station from Cape Canaveral. It's the first launch from U.S. soil with astronauts on board since the space shuttle program ended in 2011, and the first time a private company, SpaceX, not NASA, will control the mission using its Crew Dragon capsule on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. Liftoff is scheduled for 4:33 Eastern Time on Wednesday afternoon. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. And on this Memorial Day weekend, thank you to those who've lost their lives in military service. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.